105 Radio.
Hello, you're listening to Cambridge Science. I'm your friend Spanners. Some people call me Richard Reddy, but those people are being far too formal. Let's relax. This is a place where you get to bathe in science. Let it wash over you. And don't worry, because nobody here understands. Oh, no, that's just me. Dr. Andrew Holding understands loads. Hello, Dr. Holding.
Hello, Spanner. It's good to be back. How are you doing?
What do you mean? Where did you go? It's not good to be back. This is a weekly show and you've been metronomically consistent.
I've been gone for a week. I've been doing really exciting things. I've been teaching students. I was in a hospital this morning discussing how we can get patient samples and if we can use them to do some research and getting the paperwork and discussing how we can do that all properly.
Wait a minute. Stealing samples from patients to do what?
So, not stealing. Okay. There's a whole... one of the questions was, how do you do the consent properly? And
right.
Because you need to get them to sign and say... And what we're actually looking at, I do breast cancer research. We need to have in the lab, because we don't have a good access to this at the moment, actual human tissue to do experiments on.
Okay.
And I was talking to the surgeons who do breast reductions, because when you do a breast reduction, there isn't much to do with that tissue after it's been removed from the woman. And we were saying it would be really useful if we could find some people who would generously donate that tissue to science.
Well, you'd think they're done with it.
Well, they are, but we need to make sure that when we use it for science, they're all on board with what we're doing. We're on board all the process to make sure it's all tracked.
Okay.
Loads of stuff to do it right, which is the key thing. We don't want to do it if we don't do it right. But it's invaluable, because when we're in the lab, right, it's not a person, but it's cells from a person, and it gives you another thing you can use to try and make sure your research is really good. And if you get it from multiple people, you can check that your result isn't like just specific to one person, but it works across the population.
See, this is where you and me disagree, and I feel like the law is going to agree with you. So you feel like the bits of you are you, even if I chop a bit off. Like, you still think that is... So if I chop off your hand, Jamie Lannister style... Sorry, I know I'm a bit obsessed with...
I mean, if you chop off my hand, I'm going to complain loudly. But going with this thought experiment
I'm going to make a terrible fuss if you do that, by the way. But yeah, I now think that that's just like that's trash. Whereas you think that's part of you, that's your hand on the ground.
So in terms of, is it part of you and important to your ongoing who you are? You're right. It's not doing much at that point when you move a part of you. In terms of the Human Tissue Act and the laws around
taking
bits of people, that very much has control. And that's the act we have to follow. There are interesting things about that law. For example, if you take some tissue from someone and it then goes through one cell division, after that sort of process, it's then said, well, that's now something else. And we don't consider that part of a person anymore. So, yeah, it's complicated, and we have to go and make sure we dot the I's, cross the T's, and we also have ethics committees we go to and say, this is what we're going to do. And they read through it and they go, yeah, you forgot this bit, or you haven't done that bit. And we go, and it's a process. And eventually we get to a point where they go, no, you're doing everything fine. It's in the interest of everyone. This is good. You know, right, the other thing we have to do is if we are going to take samples is justify there's a value to this. You can't just say, I'm going to do this because I want to do science. No,
or because you need something for hacky sack. That would be unethical.
That would both be crass and unethical.
All right. A little judgy. I don't know your ethics boards and what you have to go through.
Well, these are very generous people offering parts of their body. Admittedly, they're not using them at the time.
So,
for research. So we have been incredibly grateful. It's a really generous thing to do.
No, absolutely. No, it is. And so, for example, donating bodies for medical research, that's something I've thought about and I've spoke to my family about, because I reckon that letting surgeons practice is pretty important. Do they use cadavers for that? And I feel like that would be quite a good use of what I would consider to be mostly just a waste product of me, that's me-shaped. But I reckon people can have a go, can practice taking things in and out.
I mean, if you're happy for that to happen to your body and, you know, be a test subject for some student learning how to do surgery, yeah, cadavers are... And my understanding is actually there's a shortage of cadavers for teaching these days.
Oh, really?
Lots of medical schools don't have enough cadavers to teach on, so only a small number of schools actually use them still.
Well, I mean, obviously, we don't know if that shortage is still going to apply in 400 years, and will my cybernetic enhancements be a hindrance to the students? That's my main concern.
I mean, it would be difficult, right? If you've got cybernetic legs and arms, they can't practice any leg or arm surgery. It would be engineering at that point.
Yeah, okay. So for future engineering students, maybe. But that is something I've seriously considered and spoke to my family about. And actually, it feels like a faraway problem when you're 20 and 30. It doesn't feel like such a faraway problem. I should actually make an active decision now on that kind of thing.
But you say it's a faraway problem. I did do something similar when I did my motorbike license, was I ticked that box I'll be an organ donor, because you don't go and learn to ride a motorbike without accepting that reality. At the same time, if I'm going to take a risky activity...
It is a risky activity.
And I acknowledge, you know, most bikers will acknowledge you're vulnerable on a bike. It's a good way to accept that and say, well, if something did happen, not that I wanted it to happen, I am young enough that there are bits of me that might be useful for someone afterwards. Now, there might not be. It depends how badly it all goes wrong, but it could be. You provide a liver to someone and save their life due to your reckless hobby, which is, you know, that's my choice. And the other person who gets the bits, they benefit from my poor choice on the day, but that's how it is.
Yeah, I would say there's some bits of me are more useful than others. I wouldn't recommend taking my rotator cuff on my shoulder. And if you must take a knee, take old righty. Lefty's seen better days. But I see earlier when you're talking about, you know, taking what is a waste product from breast reduction, and I say waste product as respectfully as I can, but I think of it from the a naive, innocent point of view where you go, oh, well, it's just sort of lying around. But if you didn't have laws where people couldn't just take stuff, that would be open to abuse. Hopefully not in this country at this time, but in another world, in another political sense, you know, you can see people either being put under pressure or people inventing a procedure so that they can nick a spare arm and stuff. So you have to worry about all that stuff.
Yeah, and there are ways it can go wrong. And that's really what the laws are there to protect. And there's some historical examples. And people don't really want to know that body parts of someone they cared about ended up on a black market without knowing about it, right? You need to be able to say, no, you'll know if we do that, and it'll be done with your consent. And, you know, organ donation saves lives. So no one is sitting here saying this is a bad thing, but you want to know, right?
This is one of those opportunities where there will be other people sitting at home now going, I meant to do that. But so having this conversation, I actually don't know how to do any of the things we've spoken about. So how do I go, like, yep, use whatever you need?
So I have been involved in these kind of scientific studies before because other medical issues, not breast reduction, for multiple reasons. I mean, men do have breast reductions, but I
call that the gym. That's what I'm calling that at the moment.
Whole different discussion, right? But so I had it when I was having some surgery or something else. And they literally just walked up and said, do you want to help with a scientific study? I like going, well, I'm going to probably ask someone else for bits of them one day. So, yeah, no, you can have this. And just signed it off. Because it felt like it was like, it's not fair for me not to give back to science if I'm taking a course. Like, it felt very fair and lovely. Those samples off somewhere. It was for a blood test for cancer, so it was a good thing.
And that concludes the segment we're calling Spanners and Dr. Holding Failed to Get to the Topic. And this week, I even failed to even say what the topics are going to be. So today we're going to talk about giant space worms and also how to make people out of bits of other people. And then we'll head off away from the Spanners and Holding shed and speak to some researchers. Last week, we learnt about adolescent physical fitness. I have been unable to achieve any of those aims with my teenage son. And you don't have a teenager yet, do you?
I do. One and a almost.
What? Yeah, I'm the same as you. And it
my
was
kids
just
are the same age, actually. We should really remember that.
Yeah. So what the thing is, though, like my boy is fully in that Kevin and Perry stage of the, whoa. And at the weekend, you have to like really bang on his door and you hear a, what? Leave me alone. It's so unfair. You're not my parents. It's that kind of stage that we're in. And Wahab was doing a good job, though, of motivating me to try and change that. I'm on it. I am still on it. But I don't want to abandon the problems of last week. So last week we were talking about sleep, and I have an update.
You have an update.
Yeah,
Did you sleep?
No, I mean, eventually. Nope. It has actually got significantly worse. It's solidified. So like practice makes perfect. Practice also makes permanent. So if you keep doing something, your body gets used to it. Yeah, my body's fully entrenched in the 4 a.m. lifestyle. So some days I've taken it as an opportunity to relax, you know, go upstairs, go to bed with my wife at a normal time. And then at some point I just give up, watch a movie periodically, listen to a podcast, lie there with the horror of my own thoughts, not recommended. And then eventually gets to like 4 or 5 o'clock and I might eventually drop off. So other nights I've just gone, I may as well just work. I'm just up. I may as well work. I'm a freelancer. So if I get up at 11, it doesn't matter. And then this very day, today, I had an appointment at 10 a.m., which is basically...
Yeah, that's tough. All those people who have 9-to-5 jobs sitting there feeling so sorry for you when they got on the train.
Yeah, I know.
Hour-long commute.
But to me, that's only like, you know, 4 or 5 hours sleep or whatever, and then get up and get ready for this appointment. And I was like, oh, this can't be. So I was on a Skype call with somebody rubbing sleep out of my eyes. So I'm gonna take drastic action. So I walked to the gym, did a pounding workout. It was amazing. You wouldn't have been able to handle it. A lesser man may have died, in fact, from that workout. I walked the hour back. So I'm like, I'm just doing all the right things here. Doing all the right things to set myself up for being able to sleep when I'm tired. Stopped at the pharmacy, asked the ladies there, I've never taken anything for sleep. Here's my problem. What would you recommend? Straight away, they were like, boom, this one. Only try it for 7 days. And this is what you were saying, you know, people can get hooked on it.
Some of them, yeah.
Yeah, they were shut. Only do it for 7 days, then try and go to sleep naturally. And then if that doesn't work, go and see your doctor. I was like, okay, that sounds like a good first plan. Yeah, sleeping pills are not beyond the wit of man. They're not scary. Other people have taken them. So I'm like, okay, good. Come home, eat a healthy pre-made chicken and rice thing, yeah, high protein, healthy, on a health trip, because my wife said I was fat recently, on a health trip. And then, no, she said, oh, no, you are looking in better shape, but you've got the, you know, belly. I'm like, yeah, that's where the food goes. Otherwise, where do I keep the food? I don't know. Like, when you're, like, as old as us, like, you're meant to have, you're a dad, you're meant to have a little...
It's your dad bod.
Yeah, you're meant to have a little dad sack, you know.
A dad sack's something completely different.
Okay, dad... belly, but I think,
pod, fine.
But I don't think of myself as needing like a footballer's stomach. I don't need washboard abs at this point. But anyway, I was like, okay.
But maybe your wife does.
Okay, she never used to care, and now she's going to the gym. Now she cares. So okay, so we're working on that. That's all good. And I'm like, right, I'm in good shape. I'll just, you know, what I'll do though, because I'm not speaking to Dr. Holding until later. I'll just have a little lie down, full on 2 hour sleep. In the late afternoon, sleeping pills or no, this is the wrong day to try them, isn't it? Because I don't think I've got any chance of going to sleep.
Bad choices were made.
All around, I've made horrible choices. Okay.
No, I hope you get that. I hope you work this out.
So I think tonight, I'm not going to torture myself. I've got loads of work, so I'm going to do that and then try and set my alarm early for tomorrow, not have a 2 hour nap late afternoon, and then I'm going to try the sleeping pills. So I'll fill everybody in next week.
And gym every day, right?
Anyway, sorry, the bumper. You can't talk over the bumper, Andrew, so I can't give you any more information. It's a very important music bumper. Otherwise, people won't know what they're listening to. 105 Radio. Since we're talking about bits of people, why don't we start with your article where you said we can make people from bits of people.
Yes, we'll do that once I put up.
So now you have to see you. I'm inviting you to go all presentery where you go, yes, that's right. From the recent article from cleversciencepeople.com, here's my opinion. You're still searching for the website, aren't you?
No, I was trying to make sure the tab that has you in came back to front. I like to look at you. Right, yeah, so this is research. I remember how to speak in a minute. Research sheds light on new strategy to treat infertility. And this comes from Oregon Health and Science University. And this is actually, I find it really interesting. Maybe you don't, but do you remember Dolly the sheep?
The clone from the Scottish clone?
Of a sheep, yes.
Yeah, but they were in Scotland, weren't they? Dolly the sheep?
I don't think the sheep really had a passport.
No, but I think the research was in Scotland. And I want to give the Scots their props. Yeah, they had all the budget and all the brains in the world, and they said, see that sheep there? I'm going to make another one just like it.
Yeah, so Dolly was a cloned sheep. And one of the... when you clone, obviously, you have all the DNA from the parent coming through.
I understand DNA from the parent. So right.
Because you know you have a set of chromosomes from your mum and a set of chromosomes from your dad.
It was 50-50. I could have got the lithe side, or I could have got the jolly side. I got the jolly side.
So Dolly the sheep. We don't ever got... no one checked the chemo with Dolly the sheep, but it got all its chromosomes just from one other sheep. That's why it's a clone. Now, if you want to go and treat infertility, so people who are, for whatever reason, unable to have kids, something happens, and you know, these people want to have babies, you need some way to have the cells that grow up into human beings, so they're egg cells or sperm cells. The trouble with Dolly the sheep is you then don't have a mum and a daddy, right? Because people who generally have infertility, they want to have the genes from a mum and the dad, like you got. Yeah. So this is important. One way people have thought about doing this is you take cell from the body and then you revert it all the way back to a stem cell and grow the sperm or grow the egg cell, which is quite hard. It's quite cool. The stem cells are these cells that like can become any other cell in the body. So in theory, that will
work. So you can make it a sperm cell. Isn't that called something fancy like a zygotion?
Yes.
Zygototron. Is
that's
it zygote?
Exactly so.
Is it zygote?
Gamete.
Gamete. Look at you going, yeah, that's close. Completely different word.
No, zygote's the same area. But I just thought I used a different word to, you know.
Nice, make me belittle me. Got it.
I've got to win some arguments with you. I don't get to win any of the other ones. And, so that's like one way of doing it. But actually, to get something to become a stem cell and to make it become the cell type you want is really, really hard. Like, people do this in labs now. We're quite good at it, but things happen like the cells go, no, I want to be a different type of cell today. And,
yeah.
And things like that. So it's not the easiest way of doing it. Well, what this research group have been trying with is, can we get a cell to go take the DNA and make it split the chromosomes for us? Don't go the whole way back to the stem cell, but go back to that half cell state with only half the chromosomes from the mum. So then they can then put half the chromosomes from the dad in. So they sort of found a way to shortcut it.
Okay, so that means you can just take a blood sample or any kind of living cell, and it will. When you say it, what is it? What does it for you? What makes it happen?
So what they found that if they then take the DNA from the mother, put it into these cells they've generated, that the cell does sort of this half division, and that's they're saying it's due to the cytoplasm in the cell, so the stuff in the cell. So they'll be able to get the half division without going the whole way back to stem cell.
Okay, but then how do you make that half division be in an egg or a sperm?
So you can do it. You do it in an egg cell. You remove stuff from.
Oh, you can just do that. You can just scrape out the stuff from a. Can you do that with a sperm as well? Can you take out the bits?
Yeah, it's less dumb. So when they did Dolly the sheep, they took the skin cell, they took the DNA and put it all into the eggshell. The trick they've added here is they've managed to put an extra step in. So, yeah, Dolly the sheep in Scotland, happily born, doing well, but didn't get the chromosome shift we need. Here, what they did was they can now make an embryo from two parents, because they, instead of going all the DNA from one point, they get the cell to go for a division, and then it splits the chromosomes up for them.
We should say this is from Science Daily. Do we know the group that did it?
So the actual publication is in Science Advances, the journal. Science Daily is the news site.
Got it.
And, there's a long team of names.
Pick three.
Pick three.
Yeah.
Well, no, we'll pick Nuria Gutierrez.
I'd have picked the one.
He's the lead author.
Yeah, okay. Okay, good. That's good. So this is great because, I mean, when we're unable to do things in the natural way, yeah, but mummy and daddy still love each other very much, we can basically recreate that process. So I don't know if this is more common, but I feel like anecdotally you hear of more people who are having fertility issues, and I think it could be age-related as well, with people waiting a little bit longer.
I'm sure that is an effect. But there's also the fact that IVF's more available now, right? Because you can do it. So you're hit, like many things, you hear about more of it. But this I think is really cool, because there are people who, the example they give is people go through cancer therapy, can't have kids sometimes. And there's nothing to stop them having kids other than the fact that you can have damaged the egg cells in the person, whole load of other things like that. So this way, they take an egg cell, scoop out the chromosomes, but they've got a way to get only half in, so the other partner can give their DNA.
So
as well.
When people have these conversations before treatment of we should store some of your eggs or sperm, does that mean that might become... irrelevant in the future, because now when you have a baby, and you can choose as well, you can say, which part do you want it to be from? So you go, you can have it, take it from my shoulder. And then that kid is your shoulder baby. And you say, you're my shoulder baby. I took a part of my shoulder and made life with you.
Yeah. And I don't, of all the options of designer babies to pick where the DNA came from, I don't think it was high up on the list of what people were thinking.
There are some funnier options, clearly.
Straight from the... But yeah, no, you're right. So for people who know what's going to happen and they can plan or have the money, because there's a cost to freezing eggs, they freeze them. But if you're not a person who has that opportunity, for whatever reason happens in your life, this is a way, obviously not yet, not today, they're doing it in mice. It needs work to get to people. There are things that aren't the easiest thing to work out. Like they're going, well, sometimes it works better than others and they haven't completely understood why that's going on. But in theory, it leads a whole new way to make babies for people who can't have babies.
Okay, let's break this down a little bit, biology. So normally, when I'm creating my code for the next generation, it takes one of my DNA cells and it breaks it in half, but it gives me a random half. So not every split is the same.
So most cells go through mitosis. Most cells just sit there doing nothing. That's the key thing. Once you're in the point of life, you're not growing, most cells aren't dividing. Cells may divide in mitosis, which is they make two, and they both have a full complement of chromosomes. So they double up all the chromosomes.
When you're talking about
gametes, like eggs and sperms, they do meiosis, which means you get the cells come out, but they only have half the chromosomes. It skips for copying the chromosomes, which is fine for a gamete, because then they're going to get the other half when mummy and daddy do the thing.
So every half that's in a sperm or an egg still has all the information of a whole DNA. It's just when they're making up the pairing, whoever's in charge of deciding what the human gets, you know, they go like row A, okay, this one I'll take from dad. Row B, we'll take that from mum, and row C from mum. So they sort of mix and match. But I think I'm alongside now.
So the only little thing that's a bit more complicated is when you get the sperm, which chromosome it gets from the pairs you have, whether it comes from who will be grandma or granddad, that is fairly random. And then there's a whole other load of other stuff that goes on. But that basically, so you don't know which grandparent each chromosome is going to come from. And there's ways the body can also switch genes between those chromosomes as well, called recombination, which is great fun.
I know that I got most of my genes from my grandmother. She was real mean. And that's why I've got a mean streak. Dr. Holding.
But that's exactly how that works.
Yep. And when you get these cells and you do it this way, from like for shoulder babies, you're getting that same random mix.
Yeah, so what they're saying is when you take the DNA from your skin cells and you put in the egg, they found this way basically to cause that segregation to occur. And that's a process that's really cool. And it's working fairly reliably.
In mice.
In mice, in a cell, in a lab.
Okay, well this opens up loads of possibilities. Obviously, for people post a treatment that would otherwise make them infertile. It extends the age, I guess, at which people can conceive easily. So I suppose as you get older, it's not that you can't have babies, but your percentages of success go down.
Yes. So there's a lot of misinformation on this. How quickly... So a lot of the data that often gets quoted for how old you can be when you have a baby seems to be based on some French data from 18 something. Absolute, because it's you sense this information. What you actually need to do is talk to someone who, like your GP or someone, and say, well, how's this going to work? And the answer is, it's not like this cliff you just fall off and you're never going to get pregnant. And you actually find, probably compared to what most people expect, you're able to have kids later. It might not happen as quickly, it might take a bit longer, things like that. Of course, there's other challenges, and this is why it's very you have to be very careful. You need to very specifically know the person. If you absolutely, the biggest, most important thing in life is to have kids, you do it, you know, you do it sooner, because anything could happen between now and that point you decide to do it. But if you're like going, I really don't want kids before I'm 40, I'm going to have them at 40, and all your grandparents and your parents are going, always pressuring you to have kids now. If you really don't want them, you probably can have kids at 40. Go talk to a GP, go talk to a medical person, because you might have specific things to take into account. But this idea that you have to have kids when you're 20, otherwise you're done, is very much outdated. And you probably have friends, right, who have had kids at their 40s, absolutely fine. There are other challenges, like Down syndrome is more common when you're at 40, but there are screening methods and there's options there. So again, have that discourse, because having kids 20 years earlier than you want them is also a big issue.
Yeah, no, don't come under familial pressure to have kids. My goodness, it's such a massive decision and there's no way back. And I remember someone saying to me before we had kids, he said, I'm not going to bother telling you what it's like because you can't comprehend how much your life changes when you have kids. So I'm not even going to bother telling you. And I was like, yeah, it can't be that different. Obviously, then I find out how different it is. And I remember saying the same thing to my friend, saying, yeah, I'm not even going to bother telling you, but everything has to change. So only ever do that if you're sure, if at all. And I have quite a lot of friends now who just went, do you know what? Nah, and have just left it and are not bothering. But what I will say is, if you have your first kid at the same time as your friends, and then those kids are friends and they're growing up together and everything, be considerate and try and match the second kid, try and coordinate it. Because I'm really upset with my friends, Laura and Matt, because they took a very long time for the second one. And that was through IVF. So I guess maybe not quite their fault. But it now means that we want to go and do big kid stuff. And they've got like a seven-year-old. Seven-year-olds are still a bit rubbish.
I quite like seven-year-olds.
Yeah, they're better than four-year-olds. Right, so here's how my liking children goes. Newborn babies, brilliant. Novelty value. Love that. They're so sweet. And there's something cathartic about a very young child like that. The pure, unruined potential of humanity. Because most of the time, that baby is going to grow up just to be some Derek who's a bit annoying, you know, possibly a bit selfish. But all that kid there, all that potential, you know, they're so wonderful. I like that. Then when they start becoming like a little bit self-aware, 2-3 years old, they are so irritating. It's on beyond belief and they're uncontrollable. And so my daughter had terrible threes to the point that, and I'm being completely honest with her, to the point that we stopped loving her for a little while. But we still did all the parent things and I love her now. But then the second she went to school, boom, something changed and she became a bearable member of society. So those are the worst ages. But then really, like...
And you haven't done the teenage years yet.
Well, we've got a 13-year-old, nearly 14, and I've got preteen. So
I think there's a good patch, as you say, between toddler tantrums and teenage.
Yeah.
Where they're in control of the world, their world, right?
Their world, yeah, you're just in it.
And teenage is like a second toddler time. Instead of being fumbling with your limbs and not being able to walk around, it's fumbling with all the weird things in society and TikTok and everything else. And it's tough life for them.
And they... you're their best friends like when they're like 7 or 8. That's a good point, actually. 7 or 8, you're their best friends for games and stuff. Whereas often now I'll walk downstairs and I'll be like, hey, kids, who wants to play a game with dad? And they're like, meh, tap, 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 phone, 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 phone. So, yeah, oh, I don't know. Well, we'll settle this scientifically. I've got a quick question on cloning to wrap this up, though. Why aren't there more clones? Because they did Dolly the sheep. They looks like they cracked it. How was Dolly? Was she all right?
She was mostly okay, yeah. Dolly had quite a good life, probably, for a sheep. Quite special. So they do use cloning.
Well.
Not people. There's laws against cloning people.
Is it? How strict are those laws?
I haven't recently checked them, but there's a reason why we don't go around cloning people.
Why, though?
Why? Well,
yeah, what?
It's a very good question. What is the actual legal motive? I mean, most people, because people are like, we don't need that.
Well, if you find a good human and you invest, say if you just find like a really good linebacker for your American football team, and then you go, okay, well, let's invest in a clone. And then in 20 years, we're going to have 4 of those.
I think designer people creep people out.
Fair enough.
Okay, I think there's a lot of things down that road which gets a little bit weird.
But
these are human beings, right? And that's why, you know, we don't genetically edit people except for a very small number of specific procedures. Because again, designer babies, do you want people sitting down and going, you know, I want this color eye, this color?
Okay, let's say there was a shortage of babies and we weren't reproducing. And the only way to do it was clones. So they picked good ones and then distributed those clones among people so that they could have a family. Would that be so bad? Those humans wouldn't...
We could use this system here. We could have babies with mixed genetic material, which will keep the genetic diversity up. So I don't think we'll ever get there.
That's a good reason to do it. So lack of genetic diversity.
Where you do find cloning is, and I don't know if they're still doing it right now, but there was definitely companies cloning cattle for beef. So, you know, and that seemed to me, it seemed a ridiculously expensive thing to be doing. But I think they just knew they were going to get really
good cows.
Cows. And you don't need genetic diversity in cows because you're going to eat them.
Oh, is this all right? Have I been eating clone cows without knowing it?
I don't know what the UK law is on cloned meat.
Yeah.
Well, you can Google it.
Yeah, I mean, that's a whole other avenue, isn't it, when it comes to meat. So I have a friend who's a vegan, and we have a lot of arguments. We have a lot of arguments. And I'm always trying to get him to say, what could we do to make the meat not objectionable to you? So he's always, now he just gets to the point where he goes, no, no meat ever. But his position has changed just to avoid arguments with me. But at one point, you know, he was talking about having a nervous system was his cutoff point for consumption. And then I told him that scallops don't have a nervous system and that he could eat them.
And he wasn't happy with that?
No.
Okay.
And I, because crickets would be a good one. I think crickets would be a good source of food. I've had crickets.
Like popcorn.
Yeah, that kind of, yeah. And it was a nice snack, salt. And it would be hard to argue that a cricket is sentient or that you're being particularly mean to a cricket.
But why not just have popcorn?
Okay, good. Let's have popcorn as we talk about movie worms. You know, sometimes there's an opportunity for a segue like that, and you just go, that's where I earned the big bucks. That's why it's Spanners and Dr. Holding, not Dr. Holding and then some guy called Spanners. I'm just saying. Cha-ching, that's where the money is. I am suffering with almost too much sleep at this point because of my afternoon nap. Okay, silliness aside, and then into more silliness, I need to remind people that they're listening to Cambridge 105 Radio. Hello. I am thrilled at the prospect of people dialing in and listening in their cars again. I have been on the radio in Cambridge before, but also primarily I'm in a podcast space. I'm in the podcast arena where people have to choose to listen to me on purpose. And that's fine if I can convince people to do that. But here, you had no choice. You just turned on your radio after a hard day. And here's Spanners talking about science and cloned linebackers and cloned beef and now giant space worms. Why are we talking about giant space worms, Dr. Holding?
Mostly because there was a movie with giant space worms, but also because, and I apologize to get your name wrong, this gentleman, Julian Nowogrodzki.
That's nearly definitely not how that's pronounced.
Do you want to give it a go?
No.
I do apologize. But there was this news article he wrote in Nature where they went and talked about the excitement. It was a Q&A on real worms compared to the movie worms.
June's
movie worms go up to 450 metres long. So they're like, yeah, we can do that on Earth. And the answer
450 metres. That's unnecessarily big. You know, if you imagine, like Dr. Ems was talking to us about estimating. If you estimate 100 metres and think of your 100 metre sprint at school, that's already really big. The giant space worm could have been 100 metres, 450 metres. That's like a town's worth of biomass.
According to this article, 15 times the size of the longest blue whale.
Yeah, so I'm just saying, 100 metres, that already feels big. And things, when you go to 450 metres, I don't have that scale when I watch the movie. I haven't seen June 2, but I have seen June 1, and then the one from 100 years ago with Patrick Stewart.
And Sting.
And Sting, yeah. Sting was in that.
I know the one.
Yeah.
It's a good movie. No, I enjoyed it when I was a kid, but I'm not sure anyone thinks
I didn't enjoy it when I was a kid. And I didn't enjoy the first June, although everyone says the second June is brilliant. But the first June, I just found it really weird. So maybe it was all a big setup for this one. But I just felt there was like loads of unearned moments. So there was a really heroic death. I won't spoil who it was. But that character was only in it a couple of times. But it's only because it was a famous actor that they leaned on, oh, well, you now care about this death. I'm like, no, I didn't care. You only introduced me to him one time. And I don't know. A lot of things upset me about that movie. But apparently the second one is good. I like Zendaya. I don't like the Timothy Chalamet guy. Because I feel like I'm being gaslit. I feel like everybody's been told that he's brilliant, and I don't think he is. I don't like him.
You okay now?
Just needed to get it. I just want to be honest with people.
I can tell. I knew not to interrupt you. So yeah. Should we go back to worms?
No, because he was in like Wonka and stuff, and you go, that wasn't good. So like, what's he been good in? Nothing. But everybody is. It's like everybody's been conditioned to go, Timothy Chalamet's brilliant, and you have to agree. So The film, I like big Hollywood films like this, so that's great. But I never got the impression that that was a 450-meter worm.
Well, it was CG, but yes, it's yeah. And then this article's lovely. I love it because it's an enthusiastic scientist, and they're like going, ah, there are big worms. So there's a type of bristle worm. They have big jaws. They're gnarly, and they grow up to 2 meters.
There's a 2 meter worm with teeth.
Yeah.
And is it in the Cambridge area?
No, it's in Australia.
Oh, good. In a way, like, okay, if you were born in Australia, then, okay, you grew up with all these creatures. If you subsequently move to or visit Australia, I feel like there's enough evidence that everything there is trying to kill you that it's your fault. If you go out there and you encounter a two-meter toothed worm, I think that's your fault, Andrew.
I think that's a fair call. If you go somewhere, I mean, they're saying basically these worms... They're big worms all over the place. Some live in water, eat squids, octopuses. Some live in Australia.
They
don't live in my back garden.
What limits a worm's size? Is it the same as insects where they breathe through their skin?
I expect very much. So insects, as you rightly say, the size of them is very much linked to how much they can breathe. And because they have these like vent systems into their body rather than having lungs, they can't get any bigger. Though the oxygen has been higher in the atmosphere at points. So at those points, we need to get bigger ones.
Okay, so how big would a worm, could a worm have got? 200 million years ago. Guess. If you don't know, guess. Yeah. But guess with authority.
I reckon it could have been... it's the diameter that's more important than length, right? You can keep going longer, but it's the diameter because the air can come in the side. So.
Oh, so it could really... The 2 meters isn't the interesting thing. It's how fat it is.
Yeah, it's the girthiness of your worm.
So, okay. I'm interested in this because when science fiction people come up with these big monsters, quite often it's just... bigger exploded versions of insects. So in Star Trek Discovery, they are able to go through slip space dimensions. But the way they do it is they have this giant tardigrade. And I think they even say it's a tardigrade, actually.
They call it space tardigrade.
Space tardigrade.
And they use it to go to mushroom space.
Yeah, but it's the size of a bear. But when you blow up these little creatures into like our scale, into our world, they do look... awesome, amazing, scary. So are they saying the Dune creature is based on a real worm?
No. This is literally a scientist getting very excited about their own research into worms. And it has some pictures on the article. So they got the ambush predator called the bobbit worm. And it one, looks like it has a moustache. It,
well, I need to look that up now.
Looks pretty scary. It's not like something... If that was in my house,
oh wow,
I would be screaming.
Okay, I'm very quickly now looking up where is the bobbit worm because that looks horrendous. And
underwater, I'm guessing.
Oh, okay. So worms are a fascinating creature. Are all worms related, or is this like trees when you've had convergent evolution into the worm form? Or is there like a family genus Wormus?
So he covers this. There are about 30 types of animal body plans, i.e. ways bodies can be laid out. So we're obviously... people shaped with limbs, four limbs, and quite a lot of animals have that. And they chop up animals, not chop up animals, they chop up like the tree of animals into these things. And more than half of them are worms.
Whoa, more than half of the body types are worms.
Yeah.
So it's a really popular build.
I find that like kind of weird because to me it's like, well, how can you have so many different types of worms when worms are quite simple shapes? But the point he makes is like there are lizards that lose their limbs and then become like snakes or other. There's lots of things like worm lizards. There's a whole load of things that are lizards without legs. I don't know why we need so many types, but we do. And they're all different body plans, which is pretty makes sense, right? Because worms that were never evolved vertebrate structure like snakes are not vertebrates. They don't have a backbone. They don't have a rib cage. So very different creatures.
Okay. So I didn't really get to the core of my question there. So are all worms related? Are they on the same? Not on the same.
They're all. We mentioned this the other day, right? Everything's got a common ancestor. So related in one sense, but in terms of like, is a snake, which he's putting in the same wormy category?
Oh,
as,
I see. Oh, I'm right. Okay, like I am with you. I do my best to follow along. Dear listeners, but I think when I start to get lost, I take that as a sign that maybe somebody else could. But I had this big conversation and realization that there was no such thing as a tree, because tree is just a shape and a type of thing that is advantageous. So lots of different types of things then evolved to be like a tree. But it would be like, I was having this argument with the kids and they wouldn't accept it. But I was like, no, no, no. Imagine that if everything that flew, we just called bird. Even if it's like even if it was an insect or a bat and we just called everything bird because of that trait to fly, that's the same as calling all trees, trees.
But then we go the other step, which gets even more weird, right? If you're trying to make categories of things, it's a lot easier to say what something is than to say what isn't in that category. So the classic example is you can define a fish, but as soon as you define a fish, everything that evolved from a fish is pretty much a fish.
Didn't we evolve from fish?
Yeah, so we're basically fish in quite a few definitions, because defining what a fish is, you do quite well. And then you get things evolve from it. You're going, well, they've still got a lot of the things that make them a fish. Now, you might be thinking gills and whatever, but you then find, well, what happens if you get a fish that's still very fishy but has developed a bit of lung? And it just becomes really hard to make a stop point. So, yeah, and this is why birds are still fish. Dinosaurs.
Yeah. Oh, here's another conversation. Most of my follow-up questions are conversations I've had with the kids. And it's always a half-heard thing that I've then said to the kids, oh, by the way, did you know? And so I got told that a hiccup was a leftover from when we were amphibious. So when you then go back into the water, you needed to make sure that your fresh land lungs didn't then absorb water. So there was a little thing in the back of your throat that like closed off your lungs, and that sometimes that now spasms and that makes you hiccup. That's what a half heard thing. Maybe
so
that was Dave
down
the pub.
That sounds a bit like the diving reflex, which we do have and dolphins have. And it's one of the reasons, I don't know if you come across this theory, that maybe we're aquatic mammals at one point.
Oh, yeah.
And no one agrees with this now. It's a fringe idea. And one of the reasons is apparently goats have a diving reflex, and nobody's ever sat there and thought a goat was an aquatic mammal. So yeah, it might be it's related to the diving reflex. I've not heard that before, but the diving reflex is definitely a thing we have.
And we have run out of time for you and me, Dr.
Oh,
Holding. No,
no,
but we've got loads of things.
One more worm fact.
Okay, well, I was about to say to you, but we do have time for one more worm fact.
Brilliant. So the last thing, and this is June related, is in June they have things that thump the ground to make worms come up.
Yeah. I know what this is going to be.
Seagulls do it.
Oyster catchers do it too.
Yeah. So seagulls thump the ground to get worms to come to the surface so they can eat them.
So the worms think it's raining and they need to escape to the front, to the top.
And come up, we go to the top, and then the seagull eats them. I do love this scientist, because he's put a great comment, is that, because you know in the movie they also ride the worms.
Right. I think that's a spoiler, though, for June 2.
Why wouldn't you ride a giant worm?
Sign me up. I think if you're going to... if you are going to ride a giant worm, we do recommend you become an organ donor first, because that does sound dangerous.
Well, this scientist is very sad to report that seagulls don't yet ride worms.
This does sound like a funny article. What do we type in to find it?
So, I mean, if you go search for Nature, meet the real-life versions of June's epic sandworms. And it's a labour of love by a scientist who loves worms. So that's good.
I think you should have more articles like that that are a little bit more fun and get taken. Because you've got things like the Ig Nobel Prizes, haven't you, where you do scientific experiments with the aim of making people laugh and then pay attention.
Well, some of those are done for all serious reasons, right? And that they don't expect the outcome
to be funny.
So, like, sometimes you just have... It's the result you got, and if it's completely balmy, you're not... It's science. It's still good science. Sometimes they are a little bit silly. Sometimes I do think people do it for a dare. But that's also fine, right? We never know those things.
Okay, let's do some live show running. Right, so when we get a topic like this, it doesn't have to be the end of it, because I've just taken loads of notes because I'd like to now talk about earthworms. So I think we add that to our list of things that we want to talk about. So it doesn't have to be an end point. So there can be more worm facts down the road, Dr. Holding. There's no rules. There's no limits. We're here forever until we get cancelled. Just talking about whatever science we want. But if you want to follow Dr. Holding in a non-science capacity, watch him play video games with an old American man by searching for Andrew Holding on Twitch, and find him on Twitter by searching for Andrew Holding. But you should probably follow me first. I'm the best one. Spanners Ready on Twitter and Richard Ready on Facebook and Instagram. Let's delve now into the world of researchers.
Cambridge 105 Radio.
Thank you to Dr. Holding there. But continuing our chat of talking to researchers in the field, we've had a run of PhD candidates, and I've been calling them, you know, our baby scientists. But we've got a grown-up scientist again on this week to talk about mental health in our children. So welcome Dr. Joanna Anderson to the show. Welcome to Cambridge Science.
Hello.
This is close to my heart because I have a 12-year-old and a 13-year-old, commonly known as the most awful human beings on the planet. So just tell us a little bit about your research, because as a parent, the constant question I've been asking since birth is, are they okay?
I had a really complicated path to actually get to where I am with my research. So my background is in neuropsychology. So I've actually started my research by thinking I'm going to work in the lab and I'm going to look at how mental health states can change immune response to different viruses, bacteria, or cancer. So this was my PhD project, actually. I was looking at response to acute stress and how it changed the immune system.
Oh, that is that. A, that's fancy, and I hate to derail you, but that's what I do. But okay, as a content creator, there was a period where I do sports. So there was a period where fans of a rival sports person were sending me a lot of hate, a lot of abusive messages, a lot of stressy stuff, and it caused me so much stress that I had a kind of physical response. I was getting stomach pains, and then I suddenly realized the link between the two, and I took the super healthy option of buying a bottle of wine. But but there's like can be a real link between stress and health outcomes.
Absolutely, there is a real link. The most basic thing is that if you stress for a longer period of time, then you would notice that you can get common cold or cold sores, the kind of just the garden variety viruses. People get more prone to those. But if it's a prolonged severe stress, they can also be more prone to more serious conditions. So stress, definitely not good for you.
Oh, no, I'm so stressed all the time. and I do actually. I get more colds and viruses, I think, than the average. So really, there's this old adage in sport that if you don't choose days to rest, your body will choose them for you. And I suppose that's going to be the same really in work. Oh, no. So I have to
absolutely.
Relax. I need that spa membership. I need it.
Yeah, your body will eventually force you to have a rest and to kind of reset because you just can't go on forever.
That makes so much sense. So how did that then lead to children and AI?
So my background is in developmental psychology, neuropsychology. So I used to work as a clinician. Work with children with different mental health difficulties, neurodevelopmental brain injuries. And then just one day I've decided to kind of focus more on research. So I used to do both before, but research I think was more of my passion. So
I guess you have a choice between changing an individual and changing the world.
The world.
Yeah,
yeah, that's what I thought what I was doing. But hey, well, we will see.
Well, so the question that I was asking you off air and that we led with really is, how do you know if your kids are okay? Because my kids were kind of adolescent in COVID-y times. So here's the key thing I've noticed with my kids' ages, 12 and 13, is they don't socialize as much. Is our feeling, and they don't seem to mind. They are happy to communicate online, and I say to my kids, like, get out of the house and get in trouble, and they won't.
They just don't want to. I know. I think it was the reason for it was that their kind of crucial period when they would be building this independence and kind of learning to, be with friends and go out and get in trouble. That got interrupted for them. So I was actually recently told about a 17-year-old who is asking parents to kind of arrange play dates for them and communicate with other parents to just kind of sort out. I remember what I was doing at 17 and it wasn't good. Yes, I think that part of the lockdown was that it disrupted their social development and they are just not as keen as the previous generation. But it also increased their anxiety levels, and we're seeing lots of things that weren't as prominent before the lockdown. Because it's a very existential thing, isn't it? It's affecting their future, and I think that they have a much more doom and gloom view of what's going to happen with in their future. So with cost of living, houses, getting on housing ladder, even a very young children now are very worried about it, seeing their parents struggling as well.
She also said to me that she wasn't sure whether she wanted to have children because it seemed like the world was not going a good way. I'm like, you're 12. Eat chocolate and get muddy.
Yeah, exactly. But also the exposure to, you know, more news, more social media. They have access to so much information now that that is just sometimes hard to process it when you're a young person and kind of know what's, you know, what to take on board and what to just disregard. So I think that's a part of the difficulty as well.
Is there anything we should be looking out for or doing if we've got adolescents at home?
Oh, gosh. I think talking to them is the most important part.
No.
I know they sometimes don't want to. And when you talk to them, you just start wondering yourself, why are you having kids?
My teenage boy, he just grunts. My 13-year-old, he just, good. How was school? How was school? Good.
I think finding common ground, you know, I think it's a good thing is that you have a hobby that you do together. That's what I'm trying to do with my daughter. I have a 17-year-old and we always were trying to find something that we like doing. So we used to climb before pandemic, for example, and then after pandemic, we used to go climbing together. And then if you spend 2 hours hanging off the climbing wall on a rope and the other person is holding you and making sure you're not going to fall, you have to be quite nice to them. So we used to have those conversations, also driving to different climbing gyms in the car. Apparently, a car is the best place to talk to your child about difficult topics because you don't have to maintain eye contact. You have to look at the road.
That's such a good point.
Be sure you don't crash if they're going to drop a bomb. But yeah, I think it's all about maintaining good communication and just knowing what's happening in their life, because intervening early if something is difficult for them is really important, because when mental health difficulties are well established, it takes a long time to treat them and it's quite difficult. But when it's something just emerging, it can be addressed really quickly and really efficiently with not very complicated interventions. So it's just spotting that moment and intervening when it's important to early on.
So the research you're doing is early identification of mental health difficulties in children and young people and harnessing technology and AI to deliver mental health interventions. So I use AI mostly to do silly pictures to troll people on Twitter with. but you're telling me it can be used for good?
Absolutely. Yes. Yeah, so it's basically a machine learning. It just uses an algorithm that predicts, based on person's responses to different question, it predicts what next question would be the most informative of the pool that we are using. And it manages to shorten the assessment that we would have to do to actually get to the gist of what's happening to a very, you know, few questions. So it takes like 5 to 7 minutes to complete it. And we have a quite accurate picture of mental health difficulties. So that's what AI can do. It could potentially diagnose different conditions like depression, anxiety, psychosis, OCD. However, what we're doing right now, we are looking at risk of having mental health difficulties. So we basically compare a person to a big population of people who are healthy or who have mental health condition and see where that person sits on a scale in terms of a score. And the higher they are, the more likely is that they have mental health difficulties. So we can pick up that something is going on.
So this is going to help people doing your old job. It's going to help people at the front line really get to something quicker. So I'm really glad that in this modern world now, the people who are like, oh, just get over it, have a stiff drink and crack on with your day, that voice is being slowly suppressed as the grown-ups are taking over and saying, no, mental health issues are real. It's just it's just like having a gammy shoulder or a heart murmur or something, and we can address it and we can fix it. Like, do you envisage this utopia going forward in the future where, do you know, a mental health issue will just be the same as going in to get your hip assessed?
Well, that's what we're going for, the parity of between mental and physical health. I think we're still a long way off, unfortunately, due to funding and workforce and so on. But I hope one day, because good mental health quite often translates into good physical health, because people with poor mental health have more physical health difficulties, they have shorter life expectancy. So it actually translates into other physical health problems. So mental health, I think, is a good starting point.
Is there anywhere we can go and follow you and find out more about your work, Jo?
That would be on our department website. So that is Developmental Psychiatry at Cambridge. There is an information on our AI mental health assessment called Artemis A. So you can Google that and have a look.
Well, Dr. Joanne Anderson, thank you so much for, well, basically frightening me into trying to sort out my mental health and also forcing me to speak to teenagers. I hope you're happy with yourself. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
Well, that was all rather lovely, wasn't it? I think we filled a nice hour of science there. What we would love is your feedback. So you can email me spannersready@gmail.com, make the subject line Cambridge Science, and just let us know if you think what we're doing is worthwhile. We're not trying to teach anyone anything. We're just trying to bathe in science. And I'm not sure there's anything else out there that does it quite like this. Usually, if you find yourself in a unique position, it's because either you're a genius or you've just had a terrible idea, and that's why no one else does it. So wherever we see you next, work hard, be kind, and have fun. Music by Matthew Ragsdale, otherwise known as Matt Two Rumpets.